Yes, coughing, the well-known sound. Who invented coughing? Was it invented? This evening, or whenever you're playing this record, we have a gentleman who claims he invented coughing. So we asked him to leave his deathbed and tell us all about his claim. Mr. Ernie Flunt.
Well, sir, originally there was no coughing in England at all.
Do you mean that?
Yes. The Romans introduced it to England, but when they left, they took it with them. With it, the Saxon lung syrup went off the market, and the spittoon industry fell into decay. I was laying in bed one night, and someone belted me round and beckoned a nut with a crowbar. Ow! I went. And then I started to cough. I thought, blimey, that's a good sound. So I ups and rushes round to the patent office and has it patented.
Welcome to Goonpod, now with Extra String. My guest this week is a returner, somebody that has been on the show last year, actually. It's Jason Krupa of Producing the Beatles podcast. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Thank you for having me. This is great. This is one weird album, and I'm glad to talk about it.
Well, yeah, because last time you were here, it was to talk about the Bridge on the River Wye LP, produced by George Martin.
Right.
From when was that, 62?
62.
Yeah. And obviously that featured Spike Milligan, Peter Sellers, Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, and uncredited Dudley Moore, yeah. So this time around, we're scrolling back a year to talk about the LP, Milligan Preserved. Again, produced by George Martin, and still considered a highlight of Milligan's career. So before we get started on that, can you just give a bit of an overview of what Producing the Beatles is all about?
It's looking at the Beatles music from George Martin's point of view, from a producer's point of view, and from a musician's point of view. So I use George Martin's perspective as a way of, you know, going into the music and seeing how arrangements were put together, how the recordings were built up step by step. And I talk to musicians, but you know, a big part of this is also looking at his career before the Beatles and the innovations he made in the studio and the discoveries he made about how to use the studio in you know, sort of creative ways. And, you know, the Goons are a big part of this, not the Goons per se, but Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan, because he really did do some very creative work in his recordings with them.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on at the moment in terms of forthcoming episodes?
Yeah, I keep saying, you know, I'm working on season two. That's been sort of a piecemeal thing. I have several episodes written, and I've done interviews with a number of people. I just need to put them together. So that's coming this year sometime. I'm not going to promise when, because they do take a long time to put together, and I'm just one person. And they're like, you know, mini documentaries. I try to cram a lot of information in, but make it coherent and understandable, you know, for people, I think, who understand music, but also for people who are laymen and don't have any type of either recording or music background.
Mm-hmm. Before we get started, just a quick bit of housekeeping. So last week, I had the very great pleasure of talking to Clive Anderson, and I hope you've listened to that show already, people. If not, get to it. And among other things, we talked about a short-lived TV panel game that he hosted with team captains Graham Garden and Jeremy Hardy, and it was called If I Rule the World. Now, it didn't occur to me until I was actually editing the damn show afterwards that obviously If I Rule the World was Harry Secombe's signature tune. by which time it was too late. But thank you to the one or two or dozen people that messaged me to point out that glaring oversight on my part. Anyway, I feel chastened. I wanted to get that off my chest. I have done so. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your patience. Now, let's talk about Milligan Preserved. So this LP, Milligan Preserved, what's your history with this album?
I think I probably first heard this about 20 years ago.
Okay.
When I started doing research on George Martin's career. And I just realized at the time there was nothing. You know, there was the 6-CD set that EMI put out that Mark Lewisohn curated. And I forget what year that came out, but you know, I'd begun collecting 45s and LPs and everything I could find and reading through old music magazines, music papers like Melody Maker and New Musical Express, yeah, and just digging up whatever I could find. And then just listening carefully, to see what I could, you know, determine about the recordings. And then eventually I made several trips to EMI archives and dug up all the paperwork on these things. So Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan and, you know, all the comedy artists and a lot of the non-comedy artists that are sort of important in that story. So, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer and, for obvious reasons, they didn't give me the Beatles paperwork, but
yeah,
I think, you know, we have that pretty well covered in other places.
Yeah. It's been quite difficult to find a lot of information about this LP. You know, I've got a number of the Milligan biographies, and it doesn't get a lot of... it doesn't really get a mention. It gets passing mention in a couple of them, but there's not a lot of data about the making of this album, or indeed, really, Milligan's relationship with George Martin. But, as I know you have, I've managed to bring together a certain amount of information, background information. I've also had help in that from people like, I just want to give a shout out to former guest, Paul Abbott, who, thanks Paul, because Paul actually supplied me with some newspaper archive material, which was really, really interesting. And I just while I mention Paul, I'd like to give a plug to Paul's podcast. Paul and his brother Gary do the Big Beatles Sort Out podcast, which is now in its fourth series. And at the moment, so what they're doing at the moment is what they call the Big 60s Sort Out. They're talking about every British number one single from 1960 to the end of the decade.
Oh, wow.
And kind of ranking it in terms of production, music, lyrics, the whole shebang. And it's really, really fascinating. And I've been just avidly listening to it every Monday. I can't get Johnny Remember Me by John Layton out of my head as a result of that podcast. Although it got a bit of a shooing, that song, unfairly, I think. But yeah. But no, if you've got any interest in the Beatles or in 60s music in general, do seek out the Big Beatles Sort Out podcast. So thanks, Paul. But yeah, so Paul helped me out with some information, and yeah, there is information out there, but it's not that easy to come by. We know that the album was released in was 3rd of November 1961 in the UK. Right. Now, there's a newspaper or a what would you call it, a record paper called Disc, mm-hmm, which had a photograph in the October the 8th 1960 edition. Photograph of Spike with Valentine Dial. And it says that Spike Milligan, seen here with Valentine Dial, is making an LP for EMI to be called Milligan Preserved. A&R manager George Martin expects it to be issued in January. Okay, so that's wow. October 1960. Yeah. And obviously it comes out just over a year later.
Right.
And before we started recording, you said that, yeah, you said it was around, as you call it, the fall of 1960 that the recording of the album began.
Right. I just like to sort of put together dates and see, you know, what's happening all around this. But at the same time George Martin was producing this, he was also working on the Peter and Sophia album.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So he, you know, he did the Goodness Gracious Me session in July, and then from September to October, off and on, he works on the rest of the album. Okay. Some of it's just backing tracks, and some of it is Peter Sellers coming in and, you know, recording things. And then interspersed with that are sessions with Spike.
Okay. I wonder if they rub shoulders in the corridor.
Yeah, it's close. It's not, you know, the next day or the same day or anything like that, but there's a session for Sellers on September 20th, and there's this, you know, a week later, September 27th, Spike is in the studio, so...
Because we speculated when we did Bridge on the River Wye whether Milligan, Sellers and Cook and Moore and Miller might have walked past the Beatles at any point. Yeah. A bit too early, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's much closer. It's within days.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of days. Yeah. So a lot of things happening close together in that year. But, you know, again, it's like they all sort of know each other here. You know, Spike and George and Peter Sellers. So, you know, there may have been some interaction, but who knows?
Is this usual for there to be like a 12-month delay in getting an LP released?
The Sellers album, I have a memo in EMI that was circulated October 27th. Mm. And it says the album will be released November 25th. And the final tape-to-tape copy was done November 2nd. So it was done, you know, within a month.
Right. Okay. So it is unusual for there to be such a gap.
Yeah, very unusual.
Yeah. Okay, I wonder why.
And there are two more recordings done. There's more work done in 1961, just before the album is released.
The Brown Windsor was cold, but the plates were hot. And... it was not long after that that Lloyd George turned it in, and he
And the voice you are hearing is that of retired redundant Mr. Aaron Kwok.
Ta, sir.
Mr. Kwok.
Yes.
I believe you have a very interesting hobby.
I believe I have, sir, yes. I study the pronunciation of words. I learn how to pronounce them.
What words do you take most interest in?
Oh, the large grafter, the family size. You know, I measure them with a little slide rule first. One's about 2 1/4 is the right size for Debrett, you know. They're sort of the epitome of learning, sir.
Oh, it must be.
It is, yes.
Could you demonstrate one of these words for us?
Yes, sir. I'll... ovipositor. Ovipositor. I think that's an Irish one, sir. The O apostrophe.
Yes. What does it mean?
Oh, I don't know what it means, sir. It takes me all my time to learn.
So, if we're looking at November 61 as the album's release, just leading up to that release date, what was Spike... I looked at what Spike was doing in the sort of summer and autumn of 61, and... he starred in a BBC television one-off sketch show on the 5th of September 1961, which was called, rather cumbersome title, Spike Milligan offers a series of unrelated incidents at current market value. And it was a 30-minute sketch show, which he wrote, and it had, unbelievably, it had people like Graham Stark, Valentine Dial, Mario Fabrizi, the Alberts, so that's Tony and Dougie Gray.
Yeah, Bruce Lacey.
Bruce Lacey, Bob Todd, people that Spike was very comfortable working with. And the Radio Times actually reported from the set of the show, corner Spike and ask how he would describe the show. He answers crisply, chaotic, obviously.
As one would hope.
Yeah. And also around this time, Spike was invited by Bernard Miles to play the part of Ben Gunn in Treasure Island at the Mermaid Theatre at Christmas 1961. And Spike was a bit hesitant about that because it was going to require proper acting, and he was a little bit unsure of himself. But it was a barnstorming performance by all accounts. And around this time with John Antrobus, he was putting together the play The Bed Sitting Room, and that would open in February 62. And there's an interview that Spike gives in March 62, which I have quoted from on previous Goon Pods, and I'm not going to go into too much detail again, but it's an interview he did for the Daily Express with Herbert Kretzmer. And Herbert Kretzmer was a friend of Sellers as well. And Herbert Kretzmer, I think he wrote the... I think he wrote the lyrics for the theme tune for the Spike's film Postman's Knock. I think saying that. Okay. Oh. But anyway.
Well, he certainly worked on... Didn't he work on some... He's worked on some Sellers tunes too.
Yes. Yeah. But he interviews Milligan, and it's a long-form interview for the Daily Express. And I just mention it now because... Spike was in a foul mood, okay? And he made sure that Herbert Kretzmer knew about it. At one point he says, I'd like to drop a bomb on the whole world. So
wow.
That's a measure of his world view at that time. But he was in a real bad place, I suppose. Yeah. And he was complaining that he couldn't get any work. And this is March 62, by the way. Okay, but I just want to read this little bit out here. Kretzmer writes, in any other terms than his own, Spike Milligan is a success. Last year, he starred in two MGM films, Invasion Quartet and Postman's Knock. He brought out a long-playing record called Milligan Preserved and a book, A Dustbin of Milligan, which became one of the country's bestsellers. His tenure as radio compere on Children's Choice was a runaway triumph. Milligan appeared in the Mermaid Theatre production of Treasure Island. He also found time to write a novel, which was Pecoon, and a play, which was The Bed Sitting Room. Yet Milligan insists on seeing 1961 as a disastrous year, which saw him tottering on the edge of bankruptcy. So
bizarre. Wow.
Spike's really got the black dog around this point. And he hadn't stopped working, really. He was fingers in so many pies.
Yeah.
Tell me about, so November 61, the album comes out. What was George Martin doing around the lead up to that? What was he working on? What sort of projects was he involved with?
Well, his year is, he's still trying to get a foothold, you know, in the pop market.
Yeah.
And he's still producing, comedy is obviously his most successful thing. And he finally has his first UK number one with You're Driving Me Crazy with The Temperance Seven in April. Mm. And there's a huge, trad boom around this period, 60, 61, 62. It sort of peters out, right around the time the Beatles come in, obviously. But he, he capitalizes on this. And this, I have said the Temperance Seven are anachronisms amongst anachronisms because they are, you get a sense reading the papers and looking at the footage and listening to the music that a lot of these people, maybe were dedicated to the music, but there was this almost sense of cosplay about it. Like they all had their, particular outfits and they kind of looked the same, but the Temperance Seven were just, Edwardian frock coats and just all dedicated eccentrics.
Yep.
Which perfect for George Martin, right?
Yeah.
And so he has that. A little bit before that, in 1960, he gets in trouble because of, he does a cover of Polka Dot Bikini and he copies the American arrangement a little too closely. And he gets some flack for it publicly.
Right.
And is on jukebox jury, basically having to defend himself. And that opens up sort of this, how the British record industry was trying to copy American hits because that was really the only way to stay current and make money. There's this sort of building tension of why don't we have more British artists in the hit parade? And it finally, breaks in 62, 63, obviously with the Beatles, it's huge.
Yeah.
But there is this growing change. So, he is still sort of having to copy American hits to a certain degree. But he is finding greater success. So the night that he finds out he has his first number one, he is recording Beyond the Fringe.
Yeah.
And that becomes a very, obviously very popular and iconic recording. In his personal life, he's edging toward leaving his first wife. And by the end of the year, we'll have moved into end of the year, beginning of 1962, we'll have moved into an apartment in London. And I don't know, I forget exactly when their divorce is final, but, you know, he's already taken up with his secretary.
And of course, you failed to mention that all through this period, I imagine George Martin was sticking pins into a voodoo doll of Norrie Paramore.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that's a big, you know, big part of, you know, his envy of wanting to have that success. And, you know, Norrie was doing a lot of the same things, you know, I think George was trying to do and wasn't able to do quite as successfully.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like getting half of a composer credit or putting your own compositions on the B side of a record so you get half the royalties, you know, things like that. George was trying those things too, but he, you know, he just didn't have that, as he called it, a fireproof artist like Cliff Richard, that he felt like he could just, you know, release a record and print money.
Yeah, is it? I think it's fair to say that he had the last laugh, really.
George Martin? Yes, I think so. Yeah. Wiping Norrie Paramore's memory from the face of the earth, practically.
So the LP, Milligan Preserve, the album itself, it includes three tunes which were originally featured in Goon Show episodes. And interestingly, I don't know if this was just coincidence, but all were shows from Series 8, and they were all broadcast between January and February 1958. So what I'm saying is, you know, he didn't just choose a song from, you know, a Series 6 episode and then a Series 9 episode. They were all from a very sort of concentrated little period of time.
Yeah.
And obviously we'll talk about those as we go through the album. Now, it's got a very distinctive cover. And a direct
front Beatles, and back cover.
Front and back. Yeah. And a direct Beatles connection, of course.
Right. And when I was at EMI, I found the transparencies for the cover, and not just that photo, but several other shots from that session, and uncropped, so you can see Spike with his shirt off underneath the table, just slightly, just yes. Cut off. Obviously, you know, cut off completely on the album cover.
Yeah.
And the story was that, you know, Spike nearly suffocated underneath the glass dome because there's no air holes.
It's a very distinctive picture, photograph of Spike sort of grinning inanely, and is it a bell jar?
Yeah,
his head's inside.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And the photograph was by Angus McBean.
Yes.
Now who's Angus McBean, Jason?
Well, he was a very well-known photographer, and you know, Beatles fans will know that he took the cover. He shot the cover of Please Please Me.
Mm-hmm. Did he do the one that they did, you know, the one that turns up on the Blue Album as well, of the older Beatles in the same location?
That's a really good question, and I should know the answer to that, and I don't.
Okay.
I don't think he did, but I should look that up, yes.
Okay.
I'm ashamed to say I don't know that.
Okay.
Off the top of my head.
During the process of researching for this show, I went to social media and asked if people have any fond memories or comments about this particular album. And so during the course of our conversation, I'm going to pepper the conversation with where relevant, comments from listeners to the show. Okay. Now,
great.
Graham Lindsay Foote, who's a previous guest, in fact, he was a guest a couple of shows ago. He talks about the actual album cover. He says, "I have a perfect copy of this, replacing a tatty one I sold in a week, read skint moment some years earlier. I love that George Martin's profile image on the back is a camel." And just to explain, everyone on the back of the album sleeve is addressed as Arabs, or in Paddy Milligan's case, a veiled lady. Yeah. And George Martin, yeah, is a camel, is represented as a camel. And all the text is in Arabic, isn't it?
Yes. And it wasn't until yesterday that I actually decided I'd get a translation of that. So I downloaded a translation app where you can just point at something that's written in another language and it translates it for you. And each of the the little blurbs, is structured. It's structured as you know, sort of surreal direction. So it says, first enter Windsor Castle, then enter the first street on the right. Smell the street on the left, which leads to Spike Milligan. Cross the street and take the first street on the left, smell right, smell left, and you will come to Valentine Dial. and so that's the structure. Each of them sort of does the same thing. They have a different location, and then it's specific to the people who are on that sketch.
Right, and but it's all in Arabic. It's hardly the yes. Seven Pillars of Wisdom, is it?
No, I was expecting something a little more, you know. I don't know what I was expecting, but no, it seems fitting now that we've got a translation.
Oh, absolutely. Apparently, three tracks from the album were banned by the BBC. I don't know if they still are banned, but they certainly were at that time. The Sewers of the Strand, because it was considered to be in bad taste. I guess it's because sewers have connotations.
You know? Sure.
And Coffer Royal, again on grounds of taste, which I can kind of get, I suppose. And Word Power was banned because of advertising. And I was trying to work out what specifically it could be advertising. And the only thing I can think is Webster's Dictionary.
Would that maybe? Be it? I don't know. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Yeah. That seems strange to me. And yet the sketch about hitting people was not banned.
Isn't oh no,
that interesting.
With the gentleman who likes hitting people, he's got like a predilection for casual domestic violence. That's okay. Yeah. That's okay.
Hit Parade. Right.
Yeah. Hit Parade. Yeah. That's it. John Antrobus.
Do you train for this hitting?
Oh, yes, sir. 3 hours a day. I've got a little boy.
What about the little boy?
Well, sir, that's another story, isn't it?
What apparatus do you use, training? What do you hit?
Well, the missus, when the boy's at school.
I see. Mr. Scrooge, as a layman, I find this hobby horrifying, and I fail to see how anybody can bring themselves to do it.
Now, look, sir, it's quite a nice hobby, really. Look.
Well,
it's 3 points to me.
I say...
There you are, sir.
Oh, just on in terms of the album cover again, it was voted, so the LP cover for Milligan Preserved was voted number 25 on the Enemy's 50 Genuinely Disturbing Record Sleeves poll from 2009, which I think's a little unfair.
I think it's hilarious. I don't think it's disturbing.
Now, in a column in Record Mail from November 1961, Richard Attenborough, of all people, is listening to the latest LPs. So he's got like this whole page dedicated to his review of various new releases, including Stan Freberg, Bing Crosby, the International Pops Orchestra, Peggy Lee, and of course, in this case, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about it, Spike Milligan's Milligan Preserved. And Attenborough says, "This one I've been waiting for almost too long. It would be quite impossible to go into detail about all the crazy humour, but if you enjoy goonery, then here it is. Having heard it once, you want to hear it all over again, particularly as you can't absorb every shred of humour the first time round. Delightful ballads like The Sewers of the Strand will certainly ensure that you're never alone when played to your friends. A stirring song like Australia will stir the blood and encourage you to emigrate somewhere. And there's a lot to be learned from Fun, Fun, Fun. Ignore this one if you can." Which was music journalism back in those days was very... I mean, I'm not saying that Attenborough was a professional music journalist because he wasn't, but I think it's fair to say music journalism in that pre-Rolling Stone magazine period, the journalism was quite dry and quite literal, wasn't it?
Right.
Like record reviews is written by your uncle kind of thing.
And they would never really give a complete pan. They would, you know, generally damn with faint praise kind of a review.
Yeah. That's it. So I want to talk, I mean, someone else on Facebook, another listener, Martin Fenton, he talked about, he said that Milligan Preserve was a beautifully recorded early stereo job by Stuart Elton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He said, like its sister album, he describes Milligan Preserved as sister album to Songs for Swinging Cellars. He says, like its sister album, it sounds as if it could have been recorded yesterday. Bearing in mind it was done on nothing more advanced than two stereo tape recorders, the multiple spikes in stereo are a remarkable feat for the time. And he says, Elton liked to record in mid-sized stereo. As an unexpected consequence, those albums and the stereo at the drop of a hat decode very nicely into surround sound. Now that's a bit too technical for me. Can you unpick all that, please?
Well, I actually think this is recorded on a four track.
Right.
Okay. I would have to dig out the paperwork from EMI, but in a number of cases, George Martin has written up the paperwork for what the session is going to be, and he'll request four track, and he'll request Stuart Elton as the engineer.
Okay.
Which, you know, we had talked about this, I think, on the River Wye album. But Elton was his preferred engineer for this. And I think Stuart Elton, you know, again, to give him credit, I think he showed George what was possible in the studio. I think he was very innovative. And I think he taught not just George, but a lot of people at EMI things about how to use the studio. And I don't remember when he began there, but he was a, you know, senior engineer. And, you know, he's the sort of secret weapon of a lot of these comedy recordings. You know, I think it does sound fantastic. I always say that the stereo mixes of these comedy albums, this and the Sellers albums, the River Wye and the Michael Benteen album, are really great examples of early stereo that, you know, when they're more complex recordings, they have this great sense of a soundstage, you know, not just sort of discrete left, middle, right, but how to spread the sound across the soundstage in an interesting way. So EMI did release a two CD set on Spike. What's the copyright date on this? Maybe it was the late 90s, early 2000s, but it has among other things, it has the entire album in stereo.
Yeah.
So if anybody's interested, you know, seek that out. Sounds great. Lots of detail and a real tribute to what George Martin and Stuart Elton were getting up to at the time.
Sure. And okay. And in terms of tracks on the album, it's a mixture of songs and sketches.
Right.
And little, you know, a couple of little sort of throwaway quickies. So what tracks stand out to you in particular?
Well, I listened yesterday again for the first time in a long time, so it was a nice refresher. Mm. I've always liked Good King Eccles Sloss. I guess that's how you pronounce that.
Yeah.
with the overdubbed Eccles and the sound effects, and you know the very familiar gunshot sound effect that shows up in lots of other things. Probably not just George Martin productions, but. Yeah, I like that.
Well, that's interesting that because that track it's the penultimate track on the LP, and I've got down here. I don't know where I got this from. I've got that track was actually recorded 10th of August 1961. I'm not sure where I picked up that information, but it's on my notes.
Yeah, it's well, okay. I think sound effects were added to that. The whatever basic recording was done. Was 24th October 1960, along with something called Approaching Trends. Is that on the album? There are actually a few outtakes from this that are not on the album. And Radio Ceylon, which neither of those I think are on
the
album.
No, they're not on. No.
Yeah.
But so this Good King Eccles Sloss first appeared in a Goon Show in the String Robberies from Series 8. And then it was repeated, the gag, if you like, or the song was repeated in Series 9 in Ned's Atomic Dustbin. So obviously Spike was very taken with it and then proceeds to put it on this LP. And it's Spike as a group of Eccles bickering between themselves and then carol singing.
Right.
And Spike also doing a miserly Scottish, a sort of John Laurie type Scottish voice, and as you say, shoots at them. What I picked up on this re-listen, though, was that at one point, all the echoes are sort of talking amongst each other, and someone asks where Dan is, and they start shouting, Dan. And now, are you familiar at all with Alan Partridge?
A little, yes.
Well, I don't have to explain to people very familiar with Alan Partridge that somebody shouting Dan repeatedly is very, very funny.
Nah, he's not seeing me. I'll get him later.
Dan!
What other tracks do you see as highlights?
It's not. I can't say it's fun to listen to, but I think it's interesting as a sort of a window into things that George Martin will be getting into very soon, and that's I'm Going Out with a Mountain. Or as it's listed in the session paperwork, I'm in love with a mountain. Because he intercuts sound effects with That's specific true. Timing. And they're very absurd. You know, it's like a circular saw and who knows, you know, what else. But he's cutting these in time. It's not just random thrown in. It's sort of meant to shock you and be unexpected. But, you know, the next year... he would do this with Hole in the Ground and Right Said Fred.
Right Said Fred, yep.
So he's cutting these effects in, you know, comic effects in specific in time to the music.
Yeah.
And then if you jump ahead a few years, he's essentially doing the same thing with Yellow Submarine, although those are performed live. Those aren't cut in. He actually has, you know, they have a session where they do this and they perform these in time with the music. So it's like... it's not music specifically, but it's timed in such a way that it sort of has a, I lack the technical language to be able to describe this, but it sort of functions in tempo with the music. It's sort of extra musical, I guess is a good phrase for it. And he does, you know, a similar thing with My Boomerang Won't Come Back, which is also in 1961. He cuts effects into that. This is part of a larger thing that he's experimenting with in these comedy recordings.
And so was this, from what you're saying, is this the first time that cutting in effects was done by Martin?
I would have to check to be certain of that, but if it's not the first time, it's one of the first times.
Yeah, okay.
Very early.
Yeah. And I'm Walking Out with a Mountain was, again, taken from a Goon show. In this case, the White Neddy Trade from Series 8. And in that show, it was Henry Crunn and Minnie Bannister singing, I'm Going Out with a Mountain and I'm Only 4 foot three.
Right.
Lengths play a big part in Milligan's comedy, don't they? Do you pick up on that?
And string in this album, and just in general. But
and Brown.
Yeah.
and on this track for the LP, Alan Clare is on the piano. And again, a listener to the show and guest on the show, John Dredge, said that he thinks that I'm Going Out with the Mountains is a total classic. And he seems to remember Michael Palin specifically talking about the track. I think I haven't actually got it to hand. I didn't have a chance to rewatch it, but I know Michael Palin was on that George Martin documentary, that BBC documentary.
Yeah.
From about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember Palin talking about listening to Milligan Preserved and having been very taken by it.
And an album that I remember very well was Milligan Preserved. I remember playing that at Oxford and It was about a year later I started doing cabaret. It was the first time I'd ever done any comic performing of any kind. And that was a sort of inspirational album because it was so free and different. And I don't know what it felt like to make it, or whether it was a complicated business with Spike's Good or Bad Days, but it had some wonderful things in, very different from Sellers. I mean...
Well, it was really your kind of stuff.
From Jan to December, they'll only remember this fun, fun, fun. Let's have...
Oh, a song divine sung by a beautiful, tall, willowy creature called Miss Patricia Ridgway. Despite her fair face, fair figure and fair voice, she only had one small piece of toast for breakfast. But when you consider what this young girl has eaten in her lifetime, 43 whole bullocks, 81 prime Hereford cows, 1,000 acres of potatoes, 207 sacks of Spanish onions, 8 warehouses of brown bread...
I don't know if you've ever looked at the back of that LP. All of the sleeve notes were in Arabic.
I don't remember that. That's very...
You couldn't get it very
piping.
Now.
Very piping.
Let me put the microphone to her tum-tum so you can hear.
As I was listening again yesterday, and I've, you know, this registered before, there is an absurdity to this that does, you know, obviously prefigures Monty Python. And it also strikes me as very Marx Brothers in some ways. There's some sort of surreal humor and just wordplay that seems very Marx Brothers to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I've always said this, I have gone on record on a number of occasions, that I think word power from this album is one of the funniest sketches that Milligan's ever been involved in.
Yeah.
It's certainly, for me, it's the standout track on this LP, and it's Spike as Aaron Kwok, which is Spike doing his kind of working class old man voice,
right?
And he's being interviewed by the mellifluous tones of Valentine Dial, and Mr. Kwok is he studies the what he says, he studies the pronunciation of words.
Yes.
He learns how to pronounce.
Right. We know from the very beginning we're in trouble.
And it's a hobby that started during the Kaiser Wilhelm World War I war.
Yeah.
And he discovered during a looting spree of bombed houses a Webster's Dictionary. And it just, I mean, I'm not going to go through the whole sketch, but it's just, to me, it's beautiful. It's surreal. It's got the usual Milligan tropes, you know. He's also got a thing for talking about legs and bad legs. He's talking about Mrs. Kwok, his wife. She's got bad legs. They're in awful shape. They're thin, and she's up every morning at dawn polishing the dictionary with brass. So,
right.
And he has to beat her as it's made of, another example of domestic violence.
Right.
He has to beat her as it's made of crowd broad.
Right.
and as with Spike's got a real problem with finishing sketches, ending sketches, and as in this one, he manages to end the sketch by Valentine Dial asking, "Is there any record you'd like to hear?" And he chooses Jesse Owens at the Berlin Olympics in 1933, which obviously is the wrong year, as well. But no, I think
I actually think that's a great way to end the sketch. It's just there are a number of these where it just takes a weird left turn. You think it's, you know, it's sort of go, and again, that's a Monty, you know. I associate that with Monty Python too, where like, you know, a sketch will just end or will just go in a completely unexpected direction.
Yeah. Well, they got that, of course, from, well, partly they got that from Spike's Q5 series.
Yeah.
And to a degree from Benting, from It's a Square World, I think.
Mm.
They've never really gone on record, I don't think, and said that, but having watched It's a Square World, there's some clear Python influences there.
Yeah. I've only seen a few of those. I think at the time when I was at the British Film Institute and I was watching things in their basement, with their permission, there were a few episodes and they did have that feel, just like anything could happen. Very absurd, very over the top.
Mm. Yeah.
The mention of puns and wordplay, I had made a note about Sewers of the Strand because it has that whole section that's very, you know, very rapid fire. And my favorite, the one I actually had to stop the recording so I could laugh, was when he says, "Let me take you out of the squalor you live in to be in the squalor that I live in."
To me, that's pure Groucho Marx.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I know Spike's used variations of that before and since, I think.
Ah, my darling little bride. We met by accident, folks. She ran over me in a tram. Her name was Beulah. Mine was Jim. I was glad they called me Jim, folks, because that was my name. I found out that she'd been going out with an Irish dentist called Phil McCavity. He walked with a pronounced limp. L-I-M-P, pronounced limp, folks. Oh, the worry turned me gray. This gave me a strange appearance as I was bald at the time. The first time I met her was late, early one morning in spring. There was a heavy dew on the grass. He'd just been thrown out of a synagogue for eating during the sermon. I told her, "Darling, let me take you away from the squalor you live in and live in the squalor I live in." So we were married in the spring, folks. We had the reception in the pond. There was plenty to drink, folks. And then off we went, folks. Sideways through those naughty sewers of the naughty Strand will be a paradise for two, not one, but two folks. Who cares if the atmosphere is blue? Who said that? 'Cause there's nothing wrong, is there, with a good old British bone? Sideways through the sewers of the Strand with you, I don't mean maybe.
Sewers of the Strand is interesting. Again, it's a song that was debuted in a Goon show. In this case, the episode 10, Snowballs That Shook the World.
I'm setting you up brilliantly every time here. Look at this.
Oh, so absolutely.
We couldn't plan this any better.
Well, it's the interesting thing as well. So in that show, Blue Bottle sings Sewers of the Strand. Mm-hmm. And interesting about this track, there's an early mention of it. So I say that, you know, the Sewers of the Strand, the Goon Show episode, is from February 58. But there's an article in Picturegoer magazine from September 56 where it gets a mention.
Hmm.
So it's been percolating, if you know what I mean. It's basically that the article, I'm not going to read the whole article, of course, but it's talking about the fact, the article's talking about I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas being a hit. And it's also talking about Milligan's contempt for the music industry, basically.
Something to do with George Martin and EMI, and, well, EMI cancelling Unchained Melody.
Yeah, he says it's Milligan's belief that a pop song is just gibberish with a melody. It says that I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas has sold over 150,000 copies. It reached fourth place in the top 20 and is indeed still selling. And Milligan's four-minute composing stint has earned him more than £1,000 in royalties and has elevated Lunacy to a new high in the music world. Okay. And then he says, later on in the article, he says, talks about Spike working with the likes of Eric Sykes and Golden Simpson at Associated London Scripps. And he's writing scripts for the Goon Show, for the Fred series, and also he's writing pop tunes. And here are some song titles that Spike Milligan has in preparation. I'm Walking Sideways Through the Sewers of the Strand. Okay. Jump Into a Dustbin and Dance, which was used in the Fred
dustbin
shows.
Dustbin Dance, yeah.
Yeah. The Yellow Rose of East Acton. And a new novelty song, Doing the Blin. That's B-L-I-N-N. Which, no idea about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But there you go. So there's a very early reference to the Sewers of the Strand there from 56.
Wow.
It's a great tune. It's not a great tune, is it? But it's amusing, particularly like you say, the middle sort of corny gag section, if you like, where at one point Spike struggles not to corpse,
right,
as is his wont. There's also the track called Another Lot, which is...
I was going to mention that one too. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, Spike loves lists, listing ridiculous things. He's done it in the Goon Show. He's doing it here. And it's an auctioneer.
Yeah.
And he's just reading out a lot for an auction. And I actually have the every item here listed. I'm not going to read them all out, of course, but there's just a couple of highlights. One anti-burglar self-preservator hand bludgeon, sand-filled and hand-sewn in brown leather. Two bottles of imitation wax fruit, one banana ruefully chipped. I love that ruefully chipped. once the property of the late Lord Frederick Crapton Lee of Monmouth. One cut glass Delf claret decanter with extra string. There's the extra string.
Yes, that's a string.
Two volumes on how to wean vultures. One volume on how to leave vultures alone. The 14-man mounted ivory monkeys cut from single wrought iron elephant tusk and signed Jin Miyakamoto of Leeds. One small brown pot containing another small brown pot. And one iron-bound Uncle Frightener in 3-foot lengths. So there's another length reference. Yeah. And so on and so on.
One anti-burglar self-preservator head bludgeon, sand-filled and hand-sewn brown leather. Two cleverly and quandric hand-operated brown oak candle holders with additional string. One stuffed Galapagos giant turtle on wheels with clockwork revolving eyes. Two bottles of imitation wax fruit. One banana ruefully chipped. Once the property of the late Lord Frederick Crapton Lee of Monmouth. One brown... with extra string. One brown leather and maquette fireside chair. One engraved Capocfield Arctic tea cozy with additional string and computer. One brass iron-bound bedstead with spring head manipulator and foot-operated mallet. A similar lot. Several and a half pairs of brown damask curtains with foam rubber lining, well known in Belgravia. One cut glass Delf claret decanter with extra string.
It's interesting as well because there's an article from the Daily Mail from July 1961. I'm sorry to keep reading from newspaper articles.
Go for it. But I love that stuff.
But this is really interesting. And the headline is, no deal with Delius. It starts, one iron-bound Uncle Frightener in 3-foot lengths, ... some brown leather boxes filled with brown leather boxes, ... one child's hangman's kit, brackets, once used. These are some of the lots offered in one of the zaniest auctions you're ever likely to hear, and you will be able to hear it in the autumn when Parlophone releases the Spike Milligan long player Milligan Preserved. What you won't hear in the auction room track is the background of Delius music, which Spike and recording manager George Martin wanted to use. The Delius estate was approached for the use of some of the composer's material, says Martin, but they objected to it being used with Spike's voice over it. Instead, some other ethereal music has had to be specially written. Milligan has written most of the material for the album himself, and it promises to be as goony as any of the Goon Shows ever were. And then actually the article goes on to mentions Martin's work with Peter Sellers and then Martin's collaboration with Bentine and the LP. So that's quite, and then Ustinov and Bernard Braden later on as well in the article. But it's interesting that, I mean, that music that plays behind Spike as the auctioneer is beautiful and they wanted it to be Delius, but obviously not.
Yeah, and George Martin composed that piece, which I think this is the earliest thing he composed himself rather than farming it out to somebody else.
Okay.
Which you know, he does that on the Benteen LP, and he sort of scattered throughout these, he'll do these arrangements.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, says to me how close he is to a lot of this material and how, you know, how deeply involved he is in these projects.
Former guest of the show, Louis Barth, he said Another Lot might be my favorite thing that Spike ever did. I find myself adding with extra string to the end of sentences on an almost daily basis. And he says, and this is interesting, I also wish that the background music by George Martin was available in its own right. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's a pity it can't be. I think he said later on Facebook, this is Louis, he said something along the lines of, you know, with AI, could it be separated from the dialogue, that music now, perhaps?
I'll give that a try. I've used that with varying success on different things before. I'll see if that works.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to mention, which is completely personal, is that as a photographer, as a freelancer, I do many types of photography. And one of those is photographing pieces for auction houses. Contract work.
Yeah.
And nothing nearly as absurd as what Spike is describing here, but it gets the tone of that very well. just, you know, sometimes I walk through the warehouse and I just like, what is this? Like, what? We're selling this? What?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it fits in perfectly. I was going to say from the For Fun and the listing, Spike interrupts Patricia Ridgway's, you know, his new girlfriend's singing to talk about how much she's eaten.
Yeah.
And he, you know, in addition, you know, 81 Hereford cows, 1,000 acres of potatoes, 207 sacks of Spanish onions.
1,700 square foot of red jelly, I think. Yeah. 1,200 weight of fish and chips. Yeah.
Mm. Right. Yeah. And then, but then, you know, puts the microphone to her stomach and it's blood knocks.
It is.
Stomach. Yeah. It is. And I believe I have my notes, but I don't have the paperwork is packed away for all this stuff, but I believe they're, you know, they had to pay a certain amount to use that sound effect.
Because it was a BBC Radiophonic Workshop sound effect, wasn't it?
Right. BBC Dick Mills had come up with that sound effect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just on that, so fun is like you say, it's Spike's then girlfriend Paddy Ridgway, Patricia Ridgway, singing and then Spike sort of interrupts. I think the track was written, I think I'm right in saying the track was, or at least partly written by Spike's wartime friend Harry Edgington. I believe. And the orchestra is the Ken Jones Orchestra.
Yes.
And Spike and Paddy, so he met her, she was an extra in the film Invasion Quartet, which he'd appeared in, and that's how he spotted her. And they got married as we've discussed, they got married in April 62, and the best man was George Martin, of course.
Right, yeah.
And Paddy, she sings, and she's got quite a good voice, got quite good pipes, really. Yeah. I think.
And George, the EMI compilation that I mentioned a few minutes ago, George Martin wrote the sleeve note for it, and just a little bit of about that. He says Spike and his first wife eventually separated, and in due time, Spike fell for another lady who was appearing in the musical Sound of Music. Patty was singing every night in the chorus as a nun, and I think Spike was dying to get her out of the habit.
Hey.
Yeah.
Good old George.
Absolutely. Now, there's a track on this album that's very personal to me as well. In as much as when my son was born, which is nearly 18 years ago.
Oh, wow.
In fact, by the time this goes out, it will be 18 years ago. You know, sitting around in hospital after he was born, and someone had given us a book to jot down thoughts, hopes, you know, for the newborn, just sort of like a really nice little sort of notebook. And I picked up a pen and I don't know why, I just wrote "My Darling Little Baby." La la dee da la, la la dee da la. My darling little baby, what will he grow up to be? The Prime Minister of England or the King of Italy? I waited 20 years or more to see what he would be. He's now a dustman in a Chiswick town. Oh, dearie, dearie me. Ooh, me. Ooh, me.
You know, I sat there in a hospital and it just entered my head and I just thought, I'd like to write this down. Because it's kind of fitting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I say, he's 18. He's not yet the Prime Minister of England or the King of Italy. and I'm hoping he's not going to become a dustman in Chiswick town, but let's see.
But you'll love him anyway.
Yes, of course, of course. And we mentioned Hit Parade earlier. Right. So that's co-written by John Antrobus, who was a keen Spike collaborator, and he plays Mr. Screws, who retired at 48 and his hobby now is to hit people.
Yeah.
Which is, it's fine. It's not, there's no great shakes particularly.
No. I mean, I think at the time it was probably, you know, we raise more than an eyebrow now, but it's, you know, it's a tribute to sort of, how violence was so much more accepted.
Yes.
At that time than it is now.
The second track on the album, actually, we haven't talked about, Coffer Royal, with Valentine Dial again, interviewing, and this is another Goon reference, because Spike doing the entire sketch using the voice that's known as the throat voice.
Right, which always, I mean, it's, I know it's him, and I know he's doing it, and I've heard it, you know, multiple times, but it's still like, wow, he's, you know, I mean, he does some, you know, such a variety of voice, but that one is just so sort of, where did that come from? You know?
Well, it, cause you think, you know, like we talk about the recording of Please Please Me, the album, and the last track recorded was Twist and Shout, wasn't it? When Lennon's voice was completely shot.
Yeah.
And I imagine, it wouldn't surprise me if he came out of that whole recording session talking like Spike as throat. Right.
Well, I'm never going to forget that.
No.
Yeah.
But he, no, the sketch, basically, it's about Spike, whose character is called Ernie Flunt, I think, talks about how the Romans introduced coughing to England and then it sort of fell out of use. And then Ernie Flunt, patented it in the Victorian period, and he was appointed Coffer Royal, and then there's lots of sort of mic flubbing as he coughs into the mic, and there's also coughing right at the start, which reminded me of the Goon Show episode, The Last Smoking Seagoon. So just throughout this album there's just Goon vibes.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Going on.
And I think we haven't mentioned Underneath at all, which is the nudist colony sketch, which is also very funny.
Right. I mean, it's tempting to quote from all of these, but it really doesn't do it justice. You really have to hear it all in context and hear the, not just the voices, but the way he's, you know, similar to Sellers, he's sort of, you know, it's puncturing this sort of pomposity and these pretenses.
Yeah. And in Underneath It All, the interviewer in this case is Graham Stark. And he's interviewing, again, Mr. Frederick Lengths, who's the founder member of this nudist colony, but he's wearing a suit due to the inclement weather and certain structural alterations.
Yes. I served this nudist colony, man, boy, and woman, for many of the years.
Mr. Lengs, I noticed that you claim to be the founder member. You are nevertheless wearing a suit.
I'm glad you noticed that. I have in the last few years, due to the inclement weather and certain structural alterations, taken to wearing the garments. But I must remind you that underneath this suit, I have all the necessary equipment for the nudism.
Mr. Lengs, what was the driving impulse behind this instinct to revert to the pattern of nature?
My suit was in bad nick. I couldn't afford a new one, but as my body was in good condition, I saw a way of economizing. I said to my fiancée, "Reen," I said, "how about me and you forming ourselves into a nudist colony?" And she took off her clothes and agreed.
How many members did you get?
Oh, we didn't go for members at first. Mm-hmm. There was just me and Reen getting the hang of it, you know.
I see, yes.
We used to go for the midnight runs. Oh, it was quite a belt, you know. In the heat, avoiding the police, and that.
Oh, there's the song Australia, which is fine.
Yeah.
That's got Bill Kerr, from, you know, famous for being one of the cast members in Hancock's Half Hour, who was also in the Peter Sellers film Wrong Arm of the Law. Spike's got a lot of connections with Australia. His family moved to Australia. He spent a lot of time in Australia throughout his life. And at one point, he adopts the Eccles voice and refers to Neddy. In this case, it's Ned Kelly, though.
Hmm. And do you have the recording George Martin did at Royal Festival Hall of Spike, June 11th, 1961?
No.
It's a reading of you know, various bits of poetry, and one of them is Australia, or part of Australia, the lyrics.
As this is Commonwealth Technical Training Week by our dear friend Prince Philip, I've...
What?
I've dedicated a little unaccompanied song here. It's called Australia, Australia, Land of the Free. I shall sing it unaccompanied, except by myself. Australia, Australia, we think of you each day. Australia, Australia, at work or at bay. We think of you in the morning and in the evening at home. We even wake up at midnight so that we can think of you. Australia, Australia, though we're thousands of miles apart, remember, if ever we chase you, you've got a ruddy good start.
I think that's more or less all the tracks on the album. And we've kind of just we've not gone through them in a linear fashion, but hey, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It holds together very well. On the whole, it's still very funny.
Yes.
And highly recommended if you haven't listened to it. I think you can listen to it on Spotify, you can listen to it on YouTube. Now, I did find a dissenting opinion from what I've just said there, in terms of a rather negative review of the album, again from Disc, and this is dated 6th of January 1962, and it says Milligan Preserved, disappointing in view of the fact that it stars the arch goon of them all. Maybe Spike needs Harry Secombe and Peter Sellers around to inspire him to the heights of his comic lunacy. Parts of this set are funny, especially the reminiscences of the nudist colony founder in Underneath It All and the Eccles family's carol singing expedition in Good King Eccleslas. Others, like Word Power and Another Lot, are singularly unfunny. What? Not having that. And rather pointless into the bargain. Well, Spike never argued that his humour had a point, I would say. And Spike's talents for throaty coughing and indigestion effects should at least have a humorous context and showcase to justify their vulgarity. So, the rather po-faced review of the album.
That is pretty negative. I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I don't recall too many reviews like that back in, from the things that I've seen in the early 60s, but obviously they exist.
Yeah. 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 So anything else you want to cover that we've not had a chance to talk about yet, or any further thoughts, comments?
I think we've pretty much covered. Again, you know, I look at this from the George Martin perspective and how this fits into his, you know, his developing production aesthetic and his and how he's working out these ideas.
Mm.
And I think these are important proving grounds for moving toward what will eventually happen with the Beatles. You know, he's gaining a mastery of the studio, and really, there's a great sense of play in all of this, right?
Yes.
Where, you know, it's, you know, pointless. Okay, well, who cares? It's to make people laugh. It's to have fun. It's to experiment. It's to, you know, no one else is putting things like this on record.
Well, the other thing as well, that review I just mentions the word vulgarity.
Hmm.
And applies it to the Coffer Royal sketch. But the thing about this period, of course, there was only so much that Spike could get away with.
Yeah.
And as, you know, the years went on, and as we get into the 70s and the Q series and other shows that he was involved with, vulgarity really crept in, and there was a lot of jokes about boobs and the like. And yeah. Just, you know, stuff like that. And I've got no problem with that sort of stuff. That's fine. But, you know, this is 1960, 61. And Spike, he's restrained by the mores of the time. Mm. So it's much more about the silliness, yeah, than shock value. There's nothing really shocking on this album. It's built on a foundation of silliness.
And I think absurdity, you know.
Absurdity, yeah.
That's what I take away from this in particular. I mean, I think this is, the Sellers albums have a certain amount of that. And I think, you know, the Michael Benteen album does too, but this is really just like pushing the absurdity into the fore. That's just a big part of it.
Yeah.
And anarchic, you know, it is that sort of thing. The ending, the finale, really, you know, it sets you up, and then it just does this, like,
oh yeah,
because crash.
It's, yeah, you know? The finale is an attempt. Spike attempts to sing a, I don't know, what would you call it, a rousing show closer, if you like,
right,
and it's curtailed immediately by some unseen assailant. He's,
yeah, shoots him with an arrow.
That's it. It's one of those little quickies, like very little quickies, like on. Is it Songs for Swinging Cellars where he does George Gershwin?
Yeah.
But no, brilliant album, and you know, I'm glad that we've had a chance to do a deep dive into it. There's probably a lot more that we could have said, but unfortunately, as I said, there's not a huge amount of background information on it.
Yeah, but I mean, well worth your time. I did find, I don't have a copy of it anymore, but there was the, is it Box 51 or 61? It was a
yes,
compilation, yeah, of Spike material, and in there is a picture from the sessions. I forget who's in the photo, but it's you know, it's a posed photo somewhere in EMI in the control room, I think.
Yeah, I've certainly seen a picture of them sitting like listening to a playback.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Milligan's laughing. I think Martin is just out of shot.
I don't recall. But I mean, basically, you know, to anyone hearing this, I think it's, if you're interested even broadly, you know, tangentially in the subject, it's worth hearing. And I think, you know, any Beatles fan, I think, should be digging into this album and the Sellers albums. Very, very important sort of forerunner stuff.
Absolutely.
And I'll be discussing these things on the podcast in much less detail than we're doing here, and from some sort of a more, you know, production point of view.
Yeah. And maybe next year, not this year, but next year, perhaps, if you're up for it, you could come back and talk about the Benteen.
Yes, LP. Would love to. That'd I love good. That album. I yeah. love that album.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, Jason, thank you so much for bringing all your knowledge and enthusiasm to this show.
Thank you for having me. I mean, you brought a lot to me. There were a lot of things I had not heard before, so this is great.
Well, listen, all the best as well with the podcast and your continuing endeavors and your auction room photography.
Thank you. And, and there will be, I will say, a little sort of promotion beforehand, is that I'm working on another book with Ken Womack right now.
Oh,
on,
right.
Solo Beatles in 74 and all the drama and weird activities and projects that they have going on, which is, I've learned a lot, you know, just in researching this that had no idea about before, just crazy stuff. So
now I haven't yet read the Mal Evans book by Ken Womack.
Yeah.
What's that like?
It's very in depth. Like it's difficult to say. I mean, it is about Mal, and what's the best way to describe it? I mean, obviously tons of detail, but you know, it's sort of a study in the, you know, the dangers of fame and the danger, you know, people who are very close to fame.
Yeah.
And really, you know, paints a very vivid 3D picture of who Mal Evans was.
Yeah.
In a very compassionate way, you know. And you'll pick up little things about the Beatles too, but it's not specifically a, you know, Beatles-centric book. It's his story.
What always amuses me or baffles me, I'm not quite sure what emotion it elicits, but the fact that all through the period of the Beatles and post-Beatles, where Mal Evans was working with them, for them, you know, both he and Neil Aspinall were on a salary of something like, what was it, £17 a week or something like
yeah,
that.
It was ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no retainer, no anything. Just
no.
Yeah, that's part of the story too. It really does pull back the curtain for what was going on behind the scenes, in the Beatles world.
Oh, and well, the 74 book sounds fascinating as well, because that's my year of birth.
Oh, okay.
I'll look forward to seeing that when it comes out. But yeah, Jason, again, thank you, and we'll catch up again next year, perhaps.
Absolutely. I'll talk to you soon.
Oh, end of the lands, come a march.